support comes from Tub Cove. With over 49 years of remodeling bathrooms, Tub Cove can help simplify the process, offering tub and shower replacements and full bathroom remodels. Local and family-owned, with a showroom in Redmond. Designs and information at tubcove.com.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. It's a concept that appears in classic novels, time-worn movie plots, and yes, certain long-running reality television shows that I may or may not watch. It's the search for the one, a romantic partner who is also a best friend, confidant, a co-parent, or a caregiver. But for a lot of people, the most important bonds in their lives will be platonic friendships. But our next guest says these relationships are still left in a gray area. It was after forging a strong platonic friendship that author Raina Cohen realized our society lacks the terminology or formal mechanisms to deal with a wide variety of lifelong, non-romantic relationships. So she wrote a book. It's called The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. And KUOW's Diana Opong spoke with Cohen this week about how we can reimagine friendships. And they started the conversation by talking about Cohen's connection with her close friend, whose name is M.
So you were inspired to write this book after forming a platonic friendship with a person you call M in the book. What was it about that friendship that made you question what friendships can be and what they mean?
I had a hard time wrapping my head around what the friendship was. I mean, our relationship was so close that even the term best friend didn't really feel like it did justice to how close we were. And, you know, once I started to think about our friendship was so close that really the height of friendship, which we would call a best friend, didn't feel like it was enough for us. We were intertwined in each other's lives, particularly in the years where we were living 5 minutes away from each other. I would stop at her house on the way to my morning commute. We would, you know, go through the grocery store together. We would, you know, BCC or forward each other work emails. I mean, we were really involved in the day to day and also could very much talk about the bigger things that were happening. And I thought, well, you know, if this relationship is so important to me, why isn't there language for it? Why wasn't I told that I could experience this? Because to me, it was this extraordinary surprise that I could feel the kind of excitement and infatuation that I had experienced in a romantic context, but also in a friendship. Like, it felt a little bit like somebody had been hiding some prize from me and then also hiding it from everybody else.
Totally. And one of the terms that caught my attention in your book was something you called passionate friendships. And that's even closer to the kind of the romantic scale of things, right? Where friends might cuddle or handhold, but the relationship itself isn't sexual. What are some of the interesting phrases or terms people have used to define these kinds of like gray area friendships?
So passionate friendships is one term, and that comes from a researcher who was looking at friendships that felt like they couldn't be called ordinary friendships or conventional ones because of the level of intensity involved. But also, you know, they were friendships. They didn't have a sexual component. But another term is romantic friendship. So that is a way of describing a lot of friendships that existed up until really the turn of the 20th century for same-sex friends, where you would see a level of affection, physical and emotional, that now we don't necessarily think is the kind of thing you would expect among friends. Letters that were really adoring, women would exchange locks of hair. One of my favorite terms that's also in this kind of category is smashed. So at women's colleges in, you know, around the early 20th century, when two young women took a shine to each other and became inseparable, they were called smashed. And in England, they would be said to have had a rave. There are other terms along these lines, but I think they're, for me, actually, the genesis of the book came from not just my own friendship with M, but remembering a bit of history that I had read about smashes and romantic friendships and realizing that there have been other ways to think about friendship. And there's more room in between these sort of stark categories of friendship and romance than everybody else was telling me, but I had personal experience and then had this bit of history to suggest otherwise.
One of the interesting things that you note in the book is that our society and culture are built to hold the institution of marriage sort of on a pedestal. You call it privilege. And one of the ways you describe it is what you call compulsory coupledom. Can you tell me a bit about why marriage and romantic partners have come to be so privileged, but companionable relationships haven't?
There are really twin historical trends that I think of that explain where we are right now. One is that marriage went from being a relationship that was very pragmatic to one mm-hmm. where people now expect to, you know, be their confidant and co-parent and best friend and caregiver and so on. And if you're looking at that kind of transition, we went from people in the West expecting to, you know, basically exchange money and
have
their dowries their and expand their family lines to, by the mid-19th century, expecting to find love in their marriage, not just, you know, be like, you know, nice to have, but a need to have. And then by the middle of the 20th century, that's when we're finding these really high expectations that you're going to find your everything in your mm-hmm. romantic partner. So that doesn't mm-hmm. leave very much space for a friendship or, you know, prioritizing other kinds of close ties if your partner is going to be your everything, including your best friend. That's one thing that's happening. And then, I kind of imagine a graph with these crisscrossing lines. And the other one is that you see friendship really decline in its significance. So we were talking earlier about romantic friendships and being smashed. It was very normal for people to have really intense bonds to friends, not just in, you know, the 19th century, but you can go back to ancient Greece and ancient Rome, and particularly men would talk about the sort of intense friendships that were really the height of what you could experience in a good life. Then we have the introduction of homosexuality and heterosexuality as these identity categories that had not existed in the same way prior to this time period. It's hard for us to maybe wrap our heads around now because it's so part of how we think about who people are. But behavior like real emotional intimacy and even physical intimacy, like, you know, men holding hands, was not necessarily seen as sexual until that point. And behavior that had been not just innocent, but really venerated, became condemned and really not at all something that you would want to be seen doing by the early 20th century and in some cases a little bit earlier for men. I think women had some more time where everything wasn't sexualized, everything wasn't necessarily seen as deviant. So you have friendship going from a place where it was really, you know, important, sort of one of the most important things of life, often surpassing a spouse, to it becoming just this kind of vestige of its former self, and then marriage being something that takes the place in the emotional room that people have in their lives.
Yeah. And one of the things you're highlighting that I think is so important is that when we put all of our ideals, hopes, dreams, we want, you know, our spouse or partner to know us better than maybe we even know ourselves. One of the byproducts of sort of this compulsory coupledom is that it can put a lot of pressure on spouses. And there's a common theme in relationships today that your spouse is also your best friend. They're your everything. What concerns did you hear from people who maybe say putting so much time and attention on one person is too much?
Well, I think there are two things that you're pulling out here. So one is it would maybe help if we didn't put our eggs all in one basket. That is a way of thinking that we apply to other areas of life. That's why we have this idiom in the first place that, you know, mm-hmm. you diversify your portfolio and finances. It's just risky to ask one, you know, one entity to always be there. And there's research on the relationship side to back this up, that people who are married, who are satisfied with their social ties outside of their marriage, are happier than those who don't have that kind of extensive social connection. And there are, you know, tests of people's physiology, like are their cortisol levels spiking when they have a disagreement with their spouse, and the people who are more satisfied with their social connection outside the marriage had less of that cortisol response. So, you know, it certainly would help there. And I heard anecdotally the way that people who had really deep friendships along with a romantic partner found that the romantic relationship had a lot of slack taken off of it, that the friend could be somebody that they could go to to be the first point of contact if something came up, or be the trial run to have a tough conversation. I mean, one person who I interviewed said that he, jokingly, that he was going to charge his friend's future wife something like $40,000 for all the emotional labor he did for his friend, because he's, I think he made him a better partner. And then the other piece here is the relationship escalator idea, which has come out of the polyamory community as a way of kind of pointing out how typical monogamous romantic relationships fall on this trajectory that can feel inexorable, like you're pulled up an escalator, that there are these different stages you are supposed to reach, or like, maybe you can imagine floors in a building, and there's only one direction to go in. And people don't really think through them that often because they don't have a lot of choice over it. It's just happening. So those decisions can be like you date and then you decide to become exclusive and then you move in together and then you get married and then you have children, and so on. And the risks of the relationship escalator is that you might end up on a ride that you didn't actually want to be on, and that you're not asking yourself individually or in the context of the relationship, what is it that actually makes sense for you? So those are, I think, some of the risks of the ways that we approach romantic relationships conventionally now.
Yeah. And one thing I think that's interesting is, so we looked sort of from the inside out, but what about from the outside looking in? If you never do get married, you might feel like there's this whole piece of society and culture that you're missing out on, that you're kind of cut off from. And that seems like a situation where more legal and cultural recognition of platonic partnerships or companionships can maybe help out, could do some work. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, my thoughts are that an enormous portion of the American population is not married. The last I saw was about 45% of the American population is single. So that's like American adults. So that's a huge proportion of society to be really left out of legal rights, because our legal system is very much built around marriage. If you want to have somebody assigned to make medical decisions for you, or you want someone who you're close to be able to immigrate to the U.S. or have rights to your health care, so many of these sorts of rights are built around marriage. And what I came to see in the course of this research is that there have been people for decades who have been imagining other ways beyond marriage, where there could be legal alternatives to marriage, like domestic partnerships, or there's a law I look at in Colorado that's called a designated beneficiary agreement, where, very sexy term, I know, but but it's doing something that's very interesting, which is, you do not have to be romantically partnered in order to sign up for this DBA. So you could be a parent and child. You can, you could be friends. And unlike marriage, which has this huge bundle of rights and responsibilities attached to it, with the DBA, there are 16 rights, and you can check off whether you want to give or receive them for someone else. So it's more customizable. And I think it would also force a conversation for people about what role do they want some significant person to play in their lives, which is not really the case for marriage, where, again, you're expected to be everything to each other. So are you really going to negotiate on, like, what are the things you want or don't want? And I think for this huge portion of the population that's currently single, for the people who will end up widowed or who will end up separated or divorced from their spouse or for whatever reason, might have wanted to end up with a romantic partner, but it didn't happen. I mean, there are so many people who would benefit from having their legal rights protected so that they don't end up not being able to get into the hospital to take care of their friend, or having someone that they don't want making decisions on their behalf, which are the exact things that I saw happen to people who had these really deep friendships that were unrecognized by the law.
Yeah. And one of the things that also I think is interesting to consider is that, we see certain levels of closeness are seen as acceptable and okay, specifically in female friendships, but less so in male friendships, where expectations in a friendship are really tied into sort of the machismo, the masculinity. Where does that gender difference come from? Because it doesn't sound super historical.
I think one of the most interesting things of looking back in history is just how men were A little bit like chauvinistic in how they thought their friendships were better than women's friendships. So they, you know, Montaigne, the philosopher, said that women weren't even capable of true friendship because of they had a rash and wavering fire that was incompatible with true friendship. So, we've gone quite a ways from that, where now it's just expected that men don't really know how to make friends. But I think there are real consequences to being perceived as gay as a man that were not quite as intense for women. So, you know, there were laws that forbid sodomy that, you know, you didn't see quite the equivalent for women having sex with one another. I think that is part of the picture if you're looking mm-hmm. historically. And the results are like pretty sad. I write about these two male friends, one of whom is straight and one is gay. And, the straight man goes on a bit of a journey to move from the place he grew up, the kind of norms he grew up in, which were quite conservative. And he wasn't supposed to, you know, touch a man, like do any, like be any, be close to a man. He still says that, like, his dad won't sit next to him on the couch. He'll, like, leave some space in between and can't remember the time. He can't remember the last time his dad hugged him. But he got to the point where he was able to sort of move through that and became so close to his friend that he started to wonder if he was gay because mm-hmm. he had, you know, what he said to his friend when his friend was trying to figure out, like, are you in fact gay? And in which case, like, great, let's explore that. The straight man was not attracted to men. He mm-hmm. like wasn't attracted to his friend. He just said that when his friend was gone for a week, he missed him and he liked getting hugged by his friend. And, you know, the friend says, it's like, that's just intimacy.
Yeah.
And I think that that's so representative of how a lot of straight men experience their or maybe don't experience their friendships, that emotional intimacy is foreign in a friendship, and that the only place where they'll experience that is in a romantic relationship, which, again, you know, puts a lot of pressure on the romantic partner, specifically the women, to be there. So, we are now in a place where, like, emotional intimacy between men is so unusual that men start questioning their sexuality if they even get the opportunity to have it.
Right, which those are separate things, which is one of the things you're highlighting in this book, is that there doesn't have to be a sexual component. There doesn't even have to be an attraction component. It could just be intimacy and feeling close.
Yeah, we conflate a lot of things that often go together, can go together, but they don't need to. There are different ways to feel close to each other. And I think we really narrow our opportunity for connection when we only see any form of closeness as having sex involved.
Yeah. All right. Talk to me about grief in friendships. I think we often lack sort of the clear communication in friendships that we might maybe have to have during a romantic breakup, or we need maybe a little bit more finality. And I know that I'm at risk at generalizing here, but I do think that there are a lot of people who avoid formal breakups with friends. We just tend to let them go by the wayside, or some people ghost them. I've been through my own friendship loss, and it was really weird and really hard. And I wasn't prepared. I didn't understand how that worked, right? Because it's not a romantic relationship. So it was very confusing to me. Like, wait, is this ending? What's happening right now? So why is that? And is there a benefit to breaking up with a friend? Like, making it really clear, like, we're done?
I mean, I think it's painful because we have no framework, nobody saying that this is a legitimate loss. I mean, I've experienced this myself. I saw it from the people that I spoke to, that it's so hard to even first recognize that you have lost something. Because, I talked to a grief expert who is also a Lutheran pastor, and he said he couldn't think of anything in Christianity that would, you know, be a ritual to help deal with friendship grief. And he said, you know, like, good luck trying to find a card that said, I'm sorry your friend died. Like, and that's its own really, intense form of loss that I think as a society we could do better at understanding how long-standing and complicated it is to lose a person that you love. But when I think about, you know, the experience of people going through this sort of grief, it feels like there are two layers that are happening. There is the difficulty of the loss itself, which anybody who's lost anyone in their life knows is devastating. But on top of that, you have the sense that no one understands it. No one's going to be there to help you. No one's coming by with Ben and Jerry's probably. Your boss isn't going to give you some time off of work. You don't get bereavement leave. So it makes the grief all that much harder than it really has to be than if we talked about it as something that happens in people's lives, because friendships are close relationships, and any close relationship is going to have its highs and lows, and the loss of it is going to really hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you think there is a benefit to breaking up with a friend, trying to maybe establish some type of, not ritual, but tradition, or, just rules around that for yourself? Or should society come up with that, I guess? I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's funny. And, obviously, I think very deeply about friendships, but the idea of, having that kind of conversation feels, really difficult. But it would feel less difficult if we had norms around it, because, people often take friendship losses or falling outs in a harder way than romantic relationships, because in a romantic relationship, particularly if you're assuming monogamy, what you're saying is if you don't want to be with somebody anymore, that you're not the one for me. And in a friendship, it's I don't really want you in my life, because you could have one of 50 friends or whatever, 20 friends, 10 friends. Right. So and, people kind of saw it as more of a judgment against their character. If we were able to normalize the kind of changing tides of friendship, and that sometimes friendships can end, then it might take away some of that stigma that people feel and the judgment against them. So and also when those losses happen, when the breakups happen, that people would have support around them. So I think it would be good as a society if we treated friendships as having beginnings and sometimes endings too.
Yeah, I love that. Raina Cohen is the author of The Other Significant Others, Reimagining Life with Friendship at the Center. She's also a producer and editor for the NPR podcast Embedded. Raina, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me to be here and talk about friendship.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.